Hey, and welcome to the third episode of Chatchy Chats. This is a podcast about bodies, life, and everything that makes us human. I'm Dani, and I've been running the Chatchy Power Project since the start of 2017, and I've been trying very hard to unravel the relationships we have to our bodies. In this episode of Chatchy Chats, I speak to Emily Yates, a sex educator, journalist, and accessibility consultant about the essential work she does to educate disabled and non-disabled people. We talk about dating and sex, representation in sex education, and Emily explains the best way to weed out the tossers on Tinder. Everyone should have a right to a sexual expression, so what can we do to make that possible for disabled people? If you know anything about the body positive movement, then you'll understand that sometimes these conversations can get a little bit messy. And listening back, I'm not really a fan of some of the terminology I used when discussing non-disabled bodies, but I'm still learning. And as Emily says, it's better to have the conversation, feel some discomfort and learn, than not have the conversation in the first place. In the future, I will use the term non-disabled over able-bodied. So I really hope you enjoy our chat, and here is Emily. Hello, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Oh, good. It's so nice to see your face.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited.
Well, I wanted to start because I want to do an introduction of you before you do your own introduction. Okay. So, you know, you can just like curl up and listen to this for a second. But we met at St. Andrew's Uni when we were both speaking at Sexpression UK.
Yeah.
I think that was like a couple of years ago. And it was like the annual conference for Sexpression, which is all about empowering young people to make decisions about relationships, sex and sexuality. And they run like talks and workshops and events. And I just done this talk to like a very eager crew of St. Andrew's students about body confidence and how body confidence can affect your sexual confidence. And like all of the students were like so keen. The, you know, St. Andrew's students are like super earnest and eager, and they were like, it was a great workshop. And so I kind of came on this massive high, and I ran across like the quad or whatever it is to your workshop, because I was really interested in the topic and I didn't know anything about you at the time. But and then I like spot you at the front, and I'm like, you can't not spot you because you're very vibrant. And then you just proceeded to like talk about these incredible things that I clearly have had the privilege not to ever consider before, about disability and about the accessibility of people with physical and mental disabilities to like sex and sexuality and sexual gratification. And it was throwing up all of these questions and scenarios that everyone in the audience was like, I don't know how to feel about that. I don't know what to think about that. Okay, let's discuss it. And then, you know, all of these St. Andrew's students are, as I'd already learned from my workshop, were very like eager to like kind of resolve things and figure out and get their point across and be vocal.
Yeah.
And you allowed us to have these sort of conversations where we kind of came up with our own sort of thoughts and feelings about something, which I think is so valuable in a workshop. And I think it just opened so many people's eyes to what like the lived experience is. And I just wanted to start off by being a bit gushy and saying thanks very much, because I think you don't quite realize, well, no, maybe you do, the work you do and what you talk about is so helpful to not only disabled people, but like able-bodied people.
Thank you.
So That's
so kind.
I just want to say thanks.
You're more than welcome. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, in terms of we quite often think that we are just supporting disabled people, but actually in order to change these bigger picture societal views, you know, we do have to cater for and help build awareness and education in non-disabled people too. And yeah, I'm sure that's something that we'll be discussing later, but that's really nice to know that it had that effect, so thank
totally.
You
I think you affected everyone in that room. And again, another question before I let you speak. Like, apparently this is an interview.
I just wonder, because we're going to be talking a lot about disability, can we clarify something around person-centered language?
Yeah, for sure. My personal opinion is that quite often the words and terminology surrounding disability is pretty scary for a lot of people, and there's a lot of fear surrounding using the correct or non-correct language and whether or not you're going to be patronizing or offensive. So I think we've got to give ourselves a break a little bit in terms of language sometimes. But I personally follow the social model of disability, which would describe disabled people as disabled people, not people with disabilities, simply because it focuses on the fact that my impairment is the thing that will not change and the thing that affects my everyday life. The disability is the barriers caused by society. Okay. So I don't have a disability, I am disabled by society, but I have an impairment, if that makes sense.
Totally.
But I feel quite strongly about this, that to anybody listening to this, I would prefer you to speak to people who are disabled rather than get so worried and wrapped up in language that you don't have those conversations. If you're ever unsure, always ask. And I think the biggest thing is, if anyone ever corrects you, try your best not to get defensive and to just use it as positive education to improve your knowledge and your awareness and your conversations for next time.
Good advice. I think we need to know a little bit about you, because, I mean, I've seen you speak at a few events. I've watched you be interviewed. We've hung out, we've gone to the theatre together. Every single time we hang out or I hear you speak, something else comes up. Now I know that you've gone across a desert. You've worked in Rio. You're a travel writer. You're an accessibility consultant. You sex educate, there's a lot going on. So I kind of want to know, maybe if you could just give us a broad sort of view so people get a bit of a feel for you.
Okay, so I guess I should start with the pretty obvious fact that I was born in North Yorkshire, that I'm sure you can tell from my accent, wherever I go in the world, that doesn't disappear. So I was born in Skipton, North Yorkshire, had a very usual school experience, I would say, a mainstream school, which I think really benefited me in many ways, in the sense of I experienced what I would class as real life, everyday scenarios, both the good and the bad, very regularly. I've also got a twin sister. She has cerebral palsy as well. I'm a wheelchair user. She isn't. And I had an operation when I was 9 years old to try and correct my very effective walking gait at the time. And that went wrong and didn't quite go to plan, which meant that eventually I ended up using a wheelchair. And I'm 28 now, so that's been, nearly 20 years. And I think a lot of people consider that time in my life as something that must have been so difficult and so negative. But I think I was very fortunate to be the age that I was. I was still in the kind of quite fearless childhood bubble, and I just got on with it, really. And I've been very fortunate to have been brought up by a mum and a dad and a stepdad and a stepmom who have not wrapped me up in cotton wool and who have just said, right, go on, get out there and see what you can do. And that's been the attitude that has just kind of followed me throughout my life, and I think has really helped. Nothing really to report until I was 16. And that's when I first went on any kind of journey or adventure. I was nominated by the special educational needs coordinator at my school to go on a trip with someone called the JOLT charity, the Journey of a Lifetime Trust. And they take 24 young people on a literal journey of a lifetime to far-flung exotic locations, who may be disabled, who may have had a traumatic childhood in some way, many, many different reasons for going. And it just totally and utterly opened my eyes to not just my limitations that I think I'd possibly focused on up until that point, but my capabilities. So I wasn't able to very easily traverse the Namibian desert. We went to Southern Africa, but I was able to sit with somebody on a bus for 4 hours and chat to them and talk through those really difficult experiences they might have had. And that really made me realize that, yes, my physical limitations don't really count towards my emotional capabilities. And that's really what I focused on going on from there. And then I went to university, had an amazing time in London. And from there, I then was offered to go to Melbourne University and study in Australia for a year. Had the most amazing time there.
I love Melbourne.
Yeah, me too. It's amazing. And something really important and really precious happened there. So I was living in a college with about 160 other people, and all of them were non-disabled apart from one girl called Alex, who also had cerebral palsy like me, and she was also a wheelchair user. And she did not want anything to do with me. For some reason, she just did not want to be my friend. And
you're like, I can't understand why.
I just couldn't work it out. You know, I was really trying to build a bit of a relationship with her just for the fact that we could share our experiences and we could talk about the difficulties that we might both be facing, or actually opposite to that, we could talk about all the amazing times that we've had as disabled people. And she just didn't want to know. And one weekend, her parents came round to just kind of help her rearrange a flat. And they knocked on my door and they said that they were really apologetic that Alex didn't want to be my friend. But she'd spent a whole life trying to only really be friends with non-disabled people, because she had an understanding that if she befriended other disabled people, that might further categorize her as a disabled person. And she wasn't quite ready for that label yet. She wasn't quite ready for that experience. So anyway, me being my persistent little self, I chipped away at her.
I'm not giving up on this. You will be my friend.
And after a few, you know, fun drunken nights and things like that, we ended up talking a lot about the traveling that I'd done previous to this, and the fact that she'd not really been anywhere apart from with her family, but she was so desperate to see if she could travel independently. So we agreed to just go to Sydney for 5 nights together, just on our own, no one to carry our bags, first time really traveling independently for her. And we just had the best time. We just stayed at a hostel, snogged loads of boys, had the most amazing time. It was really, really brilliant. And the cherry on top of the story is that a year later, after I'd left Australia, she traveled from Australia to the UK to spend Christmas with me and my family. She traveled totally on her own to do that.
Wow.
And to know that you've had that kind of effect on building someone's confidence and their ideas of their own capabilities was really special. So sorry, a bit of a rambling story there, but it's a good one.
I've got goosebumps.
And then after that, I was fortunate enough to go and do some work in Rio with the British consulate, and also with an amazing company called Metro Rio, which is kind of the Brazilian equivalent of our Transport for London. And I was the accessibility consultant there for the 2016 Olympic and Paralympic Games.
Okay, how did that come about, though?
So I was invited over to Rio by the British consulate. And I'd kind of mentioned the fact that I'd volunteered at the London 2012 Games, and I was really interested in doing some more work within kind of the Olympic arena. And they said, right, okay, well, come over, but talk about your experience as a disabled person. We'll get you in touch with all of these NGOs that are wanting to do something similar in Rio and really improve access and inclusion over there. And they set me up to do a talk for the Rio 2016 organizing committee. I was giving a talk really about my life, talking in a very similar fashion to what I've just done with you here. There was, of course, you know, a translator loop, and everybody was laughing at my jokes about 10 seconds late because of the translator loop from Portuguese to English.
Oh, that's so off-putting. Like, I am not funny. Please tell me I'm funny.
And there was one guy in the middle of the audience, kind of slap bang in the middle, who was laughing at the correct time and not using the translator loop. So, you know, a very kind of stereotypical thing. I kind of just focused my attention on him because he was laughing at the right time and it made me feel better. I was focused on him and we were having, you know, quite a good time during the speech. And then about halfway through my talk, he started looking at his phone and texting. And I was like, oh, no, like,
I've
lost him. Yeah, I've totally lost him. What am I going to do now? And I just carried on and everything went really well and the talk finished. He then stood up and he said, I'm really sorry that, you know, I was looking at my phone halfway through and I'm really sorry I've not been giving you all of my attention. However, I work for a company called Metro Rio who deals with all the underground transport systems in Rio. And I've just been texting the president of the company.
I don't mind that you can't take my talk anymore for now.
Please feel free to text as much as you want, everyone. And I've been texting him and we are in desperate need of somebody to advise on the accessibility of the new line that we're going to be building to the Olympic and Paralympic parks. Is it something that you would like to consult on? If so, we've got an interview set up for you tomorrow. So that was it.
I'm busy tomorrow, but how about the day after?
So yeah, that was it. And from then, I'm really, really grateful to that man, Vivaldo, for believing in me. And we had the most amazing 3 years. You know, it was absolutely incredible.
Sounds like a love affair, babe.
It was amazing. I mean, I call him my Brazilian dad, so take from that what you will.
Okay.
But it was absolutely incredible. And from then, from being able to be a part of that and to consult on, I guess, such a global event, that's then enabled me to carry on my consulting work and move it forward here and elsewhere.
You need to give me the stats, because I remember hearing you talk about this before, and the stats about the accessibility that you created for like the metro stations. What were the numbers?
Oh, so when I arrived, I think there are more stations now, but when I arrived, there were 36 stations and only 5 of them were accessible, and when I left, 34 out of 36 were barrier free.
Boom!
So yeah, pretty proud of that. This is just going to be an opportunity for me to big myself up for an hour, isn't
and me
it?
To just like bow down. That's incredible. Well, tell me, like, you know, I know you live in Glasgow, my hometown.
Yes, I do. So I moved up to Glasgow in 2016 after, funnily enough, writing on the Commonwealth Games in 2014 and falling in love with it. And I also work with an incredible charity called Enhance the UK that run disability awareness training, access audits, British Sign Language workshops. But we also run an incredible campaign called the Undressing Disability Campaign that focuses on the sexual rights and responsibilities of disabled people to have fun, safe, satisfactory sex lives.
Satisfactory is just, you take that down a notch there. Fun, safe, satisfactory.
I should say fun, safe and fulfilling, shouldn't I?
Satisfying, maybe.
Yeah. Change the tagline. Thanks, Danny.
Sorry. So you also do travel writing. You've got your Globehopper guides.
Yes.
And I did the tagline there, which I don't need to amend, is where travel doesn't discriminate.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm just going to ask you, where is your favorite city?
Oh.
And I don't know if this is to do with it being accessible or what, but you get to decide what you're your answer is.
That's really difficult. I think, so Glow Papa Guides, I've set up with my partner, CJ, who's non-disabled, big, beardy Scots guy who can just basically help around everywhere. So it's amazing.
I'm pretty sure he's not your partner, but now your fiancé.
Fiancé!
Hello!
I don't like using that word.
Such a weird word.
It is.
But also, you proposed to him. Oh, breaking all the rules here.
I did. Oh,
can you just tell me how you proposed to him also? Because I love this story.
So CJ is a big gamer. He is, if he had spare time on his hands, his favourite things would be to go to the cinema and watch a new movie, or get all of his friends around and play loads of like retro games together. And food. Those are his three favourite things. So I organised a little couple of nights stay, funnily enough, near St Andrews actually. And I had spent the previous kind of 6 weeks to 2 months learning how to make kind of a platform retro game the two of us as characters our two cats. So the idea was he ran through the game as his character, and my character was sat there at the end. And then this speech bubble came up telling him how much I loved him and you know. And then it went to the next screen and "Will you marry me?" came across the screen. And it was really amazing. Like, he just couldn't believe that I'd made this game for him.
Effort.
Yeah.
You get an E for effort. You get an A for effort.
It was totally worth it. And yeah, he was just couldn't believe that I'd made a game for him, and he cried so much that I started to think, have I made the wrong decision by choosing to propose?
This blubber over here, like,
he's in the other room right now, so he's gonna be like, oh god, please don't tell
me. I love a guy that can cry, but I mean,
me
like
too.
But also, like, you know, don't be like a crybaby. That's awesome. I love that. So I asked you what your favorite city was.
So I think from the experiences we've had together, I would say Reykjavik. Just from the experience we had together in Iceland, it was CJ's 30th birthday. We saw the Northern Lights. We went to the Blue Lagoon. In terms of access, it wasn't the easiest, but it was up there. And I just thought it was absolutely incredible, and I would really recommend everybody to save some pennies and go, because it's really flipping expensive, but amazing.
They reel you in by cheap flights, and then the minute you get there, it's like £18 for a pint.
Yeah. And of course, Rio's up there for me as well, but just from the ones that we travelled to together.
Okay, well then, what's your favourite country?
Access alone, definitely America.
Okay.
For sure, 100%. I mean, we, CJ's family is like a real Disney family. They're really into going to Disney every year, and I'd never really been. I'd been to Disneyland Paris, but that doesn't really count in my eyes. And I'd never been to like a US Disney. And the first time that we all went together, honestly, it was the only holiday I've ever been on where I woke up every morning and I didn't have to consider accessibility at all.
That
it's just there. It's just there, ready and waiting for you. And just the freedom of that was just an experience in itself. So for access, yeah, I can't think of anywhere else that tops that.
Amazing. Mm. Okay. Let's talk about Enhance the UK. And what the work that you do with them. So what is it?
Okay, so I am a project manager for the Undressing Disability campaign. So a lot of work that I do involves being on podcasts, interviews. We do a lot of campaigning around the care environment and the care arena, and how sex and relationships should be brought into that arena as much as possible. So our CEO, Jenny, she set up the charity 10 years ago, and previous to that, she worked in care. And she had to set up a campaign called the Knock Knock Campaign because care workers were just barging into people's rooms without even knocking because they didn't even think, oh, that person might be masturbating. Oh, they might actually be having a really nice, intimate time with somebody.
Or even as simple as they might not want someone coming into their bloody room.
Exactly, exactly. There wasn't that thought around disabled people or people with additional requirements can have intimate, sensual and sexual lives. It just wasn't in any kind of care plan or in any kind of staff thought process. So Jenny really wanted to change that and then from then set up Enhance the UK. So we're in the process at the moment of actually writing some training specifically for care homes, which we really hope will develop that conversation but improve that awareness and education even further. We also run something called the Love Lounge, which is a really unique online forum of its kind where disabled people and their loved ones can write in with any questions they might have regarding sex, relationships, dating, love, and we will do our best. We call ourselves the non-experts experts. We will do our best to give those answers / solutions from our own lived experience. But if we don't know the answer within our network of experts out there within the field, we will be able to give that answer to them. And all of these question and answers are then put up online anonymously so that other people are able to read them. So for example, if you are a non-disabled person that really, really fancies a disabled person in your local area, but you're not quite sure how to go about it, how to have the conversation, how even to get to the point where you're getting into bed with each other, you may well find a question and answer moment within the Love Lounge pages that you don't really need to type into us if you're a little bit embarrassed about doing so. So it just allows that kind of further conversation to develop, even if you are not somebody that's specifically written into us, which I think is really special.
I follow, is it specifically the Love Lounge that has their own Instagram or is it under
Undressing?
Okay. Because I follow, and sometimes you see the things pop up when you go onto Instagram and like the questions that you've answered. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, every single time it's like, aha, yeah. Like just things that I just might not have ever thought about, or it's just so useful. I totally recommend people follow it.
Oh, thank you. And they don't have, the one thing that I really love about it is they don't have to be really convoluted, complex questions. Sometimes they can be the simplest of things that people answer, but it's just about asking somebody who might think about it in a different way than you do, or asking somebody who might have had an experience that will then benefit you further down the line. And I think being able to share that knowledge and just lift the disabled community up a little bit is something that I feel really passionate to be part of and really proud of.
It is awesome, and I've learned a huge amount. Okay, so I wanted to reflect on your look.
My look?
Your look.
Okay.
Because you're very vibrant. I mean, your hair is vibrant. Your clothing is vibrant. Your house is vibrant. Your wheelchair is vibrant. You are really like bright, not just physically bright, but also, and you're pretty cool. And I'm just, you know, my first question really is, you know, if we're going to be talking about sex and dating, do you recommend getting really colorful and cool, and does that help does that help your dating life? Because I might need to like absorb some of that.
Wow, that's a good question. I think talking about the look is really, really interesting, because it's something that I've actually been thinking a little bit about over the last couple of years. And ever since I can remember, you know, I remember it being like 14, 15 and just banging on at my mum to let me dye my hair and let me get piercings and let me get tattoos. Like I was just relentless, like just a nightmare. And ever since I was that age, I can remember just wanting to be vibrant, look a little bit out there. And I guess be striking in terms of my look rather than anything else. And I think looking back at that, and probably even now, you know, 14, 15 years later, I think that's still the case, because I want people to not just see a girl in a wheelchair. I want people to see a girl with pink hair, a girl with bright lipstick on, a girl that looks like she'd be fun to hang out with. And I think that's my own internalized worry and a little bit of ableism probably put in there as well, of not wanting to just be seen as a disabled person. And that's quite hard to admit, because now, you know, 15 years later, I'm really flipping proud to be a disabled person, but I still don't want to be just a disabled person. And I think that boundary is okay to be there. So yeah, very bright wheelchair that kind of fits within my clothing style.
Who makes your wheelchair?
They're called CSEI Carbon, and they're based in Turin in Italy.
Are they the ones that make the bright coloured wheelchair, or do you get it wrapped or something?
Yeah, so it's wrapped in like pink and purple paisley vinyl in the back that we designed. And yeah, it's worked out really well. So I think in terms of going back to your original question, in terms of does it make for a better dating life, I think it makes for a more confident and comfortable Emily. And I think that probably goes a fair way to improving that experience. It's been a while since I've dated. I've been with CJ for like 3.5 years now, so it's hard to remember.
But we're going to talk about dating. Like, I need for you to like hark back onto the...
Don't worry, I will.
Okay. CJ, like, go into the other room. Like, I wanted to talk about sex, but as you said, that dating was so long ago, sex seems so long ago for me. I'm just trying to remember what it's like. I'm just trying to think of my dad listening to this thing, thinking that I'm still a virgin, probably. You know, and I love sex when it's fun and loving and experimental, but like, sex can throw up a lot of things for a person. You know, I have my own hurdles to jump through when it comes to sex, you know, and I'm white and, you know, able-bodied, and I'm cisgendered, and I'm straight sized, and, you know, I have a lot of issues around sex, you know, and things like fear of rejection, body image concerns, sexual violence, safety, porn culture, emotional abuse, self-esteem issues. You know, I have a list that is plentiful, and I am, you know, living in rather privileged body, and I'm still really messed up around sex in a lot of ways. And I've had to do a lot of work to like figure a few things out. And I presume you have, as a sex educator, done a lot of work, but you have to deal with a lot of external things that impact you and your sex life. So I just wanted to know, like, what are some of those issues you might have had to navigate? And I don't presume to know, but I have presumptions.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that come up for people?
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. And I think one of the things that worries me the most is that when I do things like talk about sex and disability and on an interview, and they call me a sex and disability expert and all of these things, I immediately worry, oh my God, does that make people think that I'm like this sexual magician? Because I'm most definitely not.
Or a nympho. Like, absolutely. That's my total.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is always a little bit of a concern, because I do have worries and hang-ups and a list too. So that's really important to put out there, that even people that are sexual educators, yes, work needs to be done, but I don't think we can ever be this brilliant and perfect partner for everybody. I think you can only be your expert in your own sexual experiences, if that makes sense.
Totally.
So I think I would like to think that I've become more confident and comfortable within my own sexual experiences. And I think being in a relationship helps that, in the sense of, I think when you're dating quite a lot, there was always this worry for me, and there still would be this worry, I think, if CJ and I weren't together, of when I broke up with my most serious relationship up until now, I was so, so worried and concerned that, okay, I'd had great sex with this person, but was that just because it was that person? And did I really know what I was doing at all? And how would a brand new person feel about being with a body that was disabled and perhaps couldn't get into all of these wonderful exotic positions that, again, you see in porn culture? That really worried me to the point that when I was dating after the big breakup, I was dating people that I really, really fancied, but I just couldn't take that step to have sex with them. And it was nothing to do with them. It was all to do with me and my internalized worries and concerns that I wouldn't know what I was doing, that I would be a turn off because I couldn't do all of these acrobatic, wonderful things that I know in my head most of us don't do on the regular anyway. I know that's the case, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it actually stopped me from being sexual in that moment.
Mm. I feel like unsafe in certain situations, but there's another level of vulnerability that comes with being a disabled person, I presume. Like, I'm presuming here, but like, is that something that able bodies need to be considering more, or that you've had to navigate?
I think the thing that is a big thing for me, and again, I'm talking from a disabled point of view because I don't know or understand a non-disabled point of view. So I think this is really interesting, the fact that we can have a little bit of back and forth here, because just as you're saying, you have this privilege of not understanding my point of view, equally, I have no idea what it's like to be in your situation either. And I think that's really important to mention that. For me, trust is a big thing. Communication is a massive thing. And if I don't feel like I'm able to ask somebody to help me into a certain position, or stop them if my legs are hurting because I'm in a certain position that's making particular muscles tight or something like that, I would not get into bed with them. And I think, again, this is a presumption of mine because I don't know what your experience is like, but from what I see being represented by non-disabled bodies, I see a bit more of a flexibility in terms of if you're on a night out and you're feeling quite sexy, that fluidity of being able to go through those different motions seems quite easy in my view. And I've never felt like I've had that. But I guess the question and the argument is, should that situation be so fluid, and should we be able to go through those motions so easily? Or is it something that between all of these different parties that have different experiences, we should be able to set slightly clearer boundaries through education? I don't know.
Hmm. I think when you're talking about trust and communication, I think those are really valuable things to kind of focus on whenever you're entering like a situation that might be sexual. Mm-hmm. I know that's not always the case, and people have their different reasons for entering sexual situations, but reflecting on your experience, it makes me sort of take on board that like this needs to be something that me and like able-bodied people I know can learn from.
We need
to be having those sort of levels of communication, and that's something that I definitely think is lacking in sex education. You know, we learn the sort of basics. I don't even remember my sex education at school. But I'm sure that I learned the basics, but never like the relationship side of things, the communication side of things, the trust, those sorts of things. Never mind disability ever being mentioned in sex education.
Yeah, totally, totally. And don't get me wrong, I think there's a massive amount of of jealousy on my part, if I'm being totally honest, because I've never had a one-night stand. I've never been in a situation where I've met somebody in a pub or a club and I've ended up sleeping with them. Never, ever, ever. Have I wanted that to happen? Oh my God, yeah. that to me feels so freeing and liberating in so many ways. And just the fact that, you know, you don't have to worry too much about your body because you're only going to be sleeping with them once. And how great would that be? You can do what you want and lose all those inhibitions and experiment. And I've never been in that situation. And I think that's part of a bigger societal point in terms of course, if you just want to go in, if you just wanted to go and sleep for someone for one night, let's be honest, you're not going to be dealing with all the intricacies of a disabled body. You're not. Like, and I can't expect somebody to be in that situation. But would I have wanted that experience? Oh, yeah. So I think that's a really kind of interesting conversation to have as well. That, yes, I can provide this different viewpoint in terms of awareness and education, but wow, there are so many different bubbles that I wish that I was able to enter into.
I think maybe, like, now that you're 3 years deep with CJ, that perhaps some sort of role play is required.
I will put that to him and let you know how it goes.
And then you could be like, I am the French maid as well. Like, just throw that in there. Always fun.
I was going to say, you've definitely practiced that accent a few times.
Oh, I don't know what you mean. I know that fetishization comes up a lot, and I've learned a lot about that in the sort of the fat sphere. The fat women tend to be fetishized, and I've learned about it in that respect. But I thought there might be some element of that within disability. Is that something that you've ever been asked about or experienced?
For sure. So there's something called devoteeism, which is, I guess, growing in terms of how many people are aware of it within the disabled community. And it's quite a difficult thing to talk about and have an opinion on, simply because I feel quite strongly that for some disabled people, for quite a number of disabled people, devotees are really celebrated because, yes, disability is fetishized, but it's also totally and wholly accepted. And I think that's kind of a really vital point, that it's not something I worry about now, but definitely when I was younger, I've had disabled and non-disabled partners. And when I've been with a non-disabled partner in previous years, I've always had like a little niggling concern in the back of my mind that, oh wow, does this person love everything about me and does none of it matter? Or do they just like the fact that I'm clever and I wear bright clothes or whatever it might be? You know, is the disability just not significant enough for it to really be an issue? Or does it really not matter? Is it really not a thing? And I think the fact of the matter is, you're never going to truly know where exactly somebody stands on that spectrum. So when somebody is involved with a devotee, that must be a really liberating feeling, in the sense of, yes, okay, perhaps my disability is fetishized, but why not if it's seen as such a positive, accepted situation?
Is there a difference between a devoteeism and fetishization? Like,
yeah, so it's quite a difficult boundary, and I'm not quite sure that I am educated enough about it just yet. So there are some devotees who just wholly fetishize disability, but there are also some devotees that I've met who physically just aren't attracted to non-disabled people. They are only attracted to disabled people, and they so desperately want a relationship with a disabled person. Now, to me, that goes further than fetishization, because it's more than just situational, temporary, sexual. It's
a sexuality, is it not?
Yeah, yeah. It's a preference, I guess, but even more than that. So yes, there are devotees that sit within both of those camps. And I think the dangerous part of devoteeism is, first of all, that it's still quite an underground phenomenon, and that's dangerous for both parties. But I think the other dangerous thing is probably the online world and how easy access is to different people. there are a lot of people who have reported that devotees have, you know, just appeared in their inbox and demanded photos, or then found out where they live and followed them with a camera around the supermarket. So, you know, don't get me wrong, these people, or some of these people, can be predatory, can be dangerous. And that is why it's so vitally important that disabled people are educated around this. But then I would say, hey, make your own decision. And make your own decision whether or not you celebrate the fact that somebody's there that, yes, may well be interested in, I don't know, feeling a certain part of your body or role playing a certain thing in the bedroom, but also that will fully accept the fact that you are disabled and not think of you as broken or as a burden. And let's be honest, in society, in a wider society, those conversations are still happening and those thoughts are still there. So I think it really is a bit of a weighing scale. Is it for me? No. But I totally understand why it could be for other people.
Thank you. That was.
Does that make sense?
It totally does. I'm fascinated. I there's been lots of conversations within the fat positive world of whether fetishization is wrong in some way, and so many people are like on either side of the debate, and I see both sides. I don't think I've even come up with my own sort of like perspective on it yet, but yeah. I just like you. Learning more about it and kind of hearing people's experiences of it is important.
Totally. And I think when it comes down to a lot of these things, it's about the individual, isn't it? I am not saying that, God forbid, if anything happened with me and CJ, that I might not meet somebody who then just so happened to be a devotee and madly fell in love with them. I may well do. And it might not be this massive thing, but I just don't know until I meet that individual. Mm-hmm. And I think that just as disability is such a huge spectrum, devoteeism is as well.
Fascinating. But let's talk about dating, if you can hark your mind back to dating. Did you ever use dating apps?
Yeah. Yeah, CJ and I met on Tinder.
Tinder. Gives me shivers up my spine. You know, it's pretty awful being an able-bodied person on a dating app. And if anyone's seen my Danny Does Dating highlights on my Instagram, you will get
I'm obsessed. I love it.
There's been a bit of a break. I've not been dating since January, and now I'm back. Just decided to go back onto it. And the minute that I posted anything about Danny Does Dating, my inbox goes, oh my God, I live for these. I live vicariously through these. I live vicariously through you with these. And I'm like, but why? It's like I point out the worst profiles on how, like, you know, some guys put up a picture of him and his partner and all of his children as part of his profile, and I'm like, why does this guy think that?
I think people love it so much because it's so familiar. I think that's why it's so brilliant.
I'm so scared of doing it because I don't want, you know, one of my concerns is I don't want to put people off dating. Mm. But you know, it's hilarious. Like, you can't not laugh at these like awful profiles. Anyway, I have two full highlights pretty much on my Instagram, and that's like 100 in each. So, you know, what's your thoughts around like disclosure of disability on a dating app?
I think ultimately it's up to the person as and when they choose to disclose, if they choose to disclose. I feel very fortunate in this sense because I've got such a physical, visible impairment. I almost have to disclose because, let's be honest, it wouldn't be very fair if somebody said that they were going to book a venue for us to go to and it happened to be up 5 stairs and I turned up in my wheelchair and they were like, oh, right, thanks for telling me. You know, that wouldn't get us off on the right start, and I truly believe that there's a bit of a 50-50 duty there also on the disabled person to let somebody know and to prepare them a little bit. I think okay.
Yeah, but let's not like over... you know, it is on the responsibility of the able-bodied person to ask their date, you know, any preferences or any requirements or any needs for that date. Like, you know, it's like asking whether you want to go for Thai food or for, you know.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. I mean, I guess for me, I've already told that person before we get to that point. So I've never been in a situation where I've left it that long and perhaps they might ask. So maybe I should have done that. But yeah, I do believe that there is a bit of a 50-50 duty there. And I think sometimes we do put a bit too, I believe we do put a bit too much pressure on the non-disabled person to automatically kind of know and understand these things. And I think that it can almost heighten that fear a little bit of, oh my God, I might do something wrong now because I've slipped up the first time. And I don't think that's fair either.
Yeah, that's, I can see what you're saying. Like it might potentially lead to more stigmatization and more more fear around, you know, being comfortable dating someone who was disabled.
Yeah, but okay. You're right. You know, how nice for everybody listening to say, right, okay, before I book anywhere, do you have any accessibility requirements? That would be amazing, you know, if everybody could learn to do that. So please do, everybody. So, yeah, because I have such a visible physical impairment, I always have those conversations before I meet somebody. You've heard me say this before, but I do think it's a bit of a tosser filter in the sense of...
I have got that written down as a hashtag, tosser filter.
But, you know, I know for a fact that if somebody is not interested after that point, then I've not wasted 2 or 3 hours going on a date with them, and that's great.
Some people feel like annoyed or like that it's some sort of mandatory thing that disabled people have to disclose up front. You know, nobody shares their full identity mm-hmm. in 5 pictures and a tiny little blurb. And, you know, there's guys that don't tell you they've got kids. Guys yeah. and girls that don't tell you they've got kids until the 6th date. Definitely up to, I would say it's definitely up to the person where they want to. But I do get that there's benefits in being upfront and not wasting
souls. But I think that's a really good point, you know, and for those who have more hidden impairments, then you do have that little bit more flexibility and autonomy of when you decide to disclose. So yeah, I do think it's totally up to the individual, and maybe it is just part of improving that discussion and that communication and thinking, if you are a non-disabled person, right, okay, what questions can I ask? Because I think if you always ask an open-ended question that shows that you've considered this, that shows that you've thought about it, oh my God, that's so positive. And I think if we, you know, regardless of what it is, if it's a situation with kids or if it's a situation about another part of your identity, maybe it is about asking those open-ended questions and being prepared for whatever answer you may get. I don't think we're sometimes as prepared as we could be.
Definitely. Went on a date last night. Because I knew that I was talking to you. So like I thought, I probably need to do my research again about what dating's like online. Uh-huh. So in preparation, I did this for you, Emily.
Thank you.
In preparation for our conversation. I went back on dating apps.
Was it awful?
No, the date was great.
Okay.
No, but dating apps themselves. Mm. I mean, I'm only on one, but like, they really trigger so many things for people, and I feel a lot for people who are online and potentially have any sort of, you know, self-esteem issues, because it is like a roller coaster.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing to do with dating is I heard you speak about the British awkwardness and how, you know, we're quite a sexual nation, and yet mm-hmm. we have an awkwardness around sex that it actually creates barriers for disabled people to access a good sex life. So like you were talking about bars and clubs and public transport, and I thought, of course, where is it that you find a sex life if you're not just gonna through dating apps? So what are some of the ways that we can improve that?
I think by not just thinking that sexuality and sensuality is what goes on behind closed doors. I think that's sometimes a misconception that we all have. actually just the ability to express yourself sexually and to flirt with somebody and to have that excitement of that new conversation and anticipation of, oh my God, where's this going to go? That is it can be such a beautiful thing, and it can be such a liberating thing, and it can build so much confidence. But so many disabled people don't have access to that because of pubs, clubs, bars, public transport not being accessible. You know, you're so right. How do you, you know, it's not just about what happens when you get to the point of having a sex life. How do you find one? And we don't really focus on that as much as we should. I've learned from working with Enhance the UK, and I didn't realize myself that your sexual expression and your sexuality is involved in every single bit of what you do. Every single little part of what you do is something to do with your sexual identity. You might not think it is, but when the access to those things are taken away, it's so surprising how much it can diminish your ability to have that sexual expression and that sensuality. And yes, you know, having those awkward conversations of positioning in bed and if a certain position is going to hurt and all of those different things, if there's any particular mobility aids that you could use to make sexual positioning or penetration easier, they're all massively important questions. But we should also be taking it a step back and thinking a bit bigger, and society as a whole, that's something that society as a whole can help to improve, not just the sexual expression of disabled people, but also how non-disabled people view disabled people as sexual beings. It's flipping difficult to view a disabled person as a sexual being if you never see somebody when you go on a night out looking on the pull, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that ties back into sex education. If you've never seen a disabled body as being sexual in that sort of setting as well, and considering that as an option for you, it's like this whole sort of closed off area of society that you're just like, what has happened in society that we have think that that's not an option, or that's not sexy, or that's not sexual, or that's not attractive?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, you're so right. It goes back to sitting in a classroom and watching a video and no disabled bodies being on there. It goes back to sitting in a classroom, and if you are a disabled member of that class, those materials and those resources not being accessible to you in the formats that they're out in. So not only do we need to improve this societal picture of disabled people as sexual beings by ensuring that disabled people are represented in inclusive sex education in the media, when Joe Bloggs is watching TV at 7 o'clock at night. In so many ways, we also need to ensure that access to those statistics on safety, access to those bits of information on what to do if you ever feel vulnerable, access on ideas for different accessible positions, they also need to be available to disabled people. If you are deaf or hard of hearing and you've got a lowered reading age, for example, because you've been brought up in a broken educational system for deaf or hard of hearing people, those materials and resources need to be accessible to you, whether or not it's a subtitled video, whether it's an easy read format resource. And we forget these things. We forget that in order to not become less than sexual or hypersexual yourself, you need to have this information. And we've got such a problem at the moment, such an issue with deaf and disabled young women in particular being three times as likely to experience some kind of sexual violence or abuse than their non-disabled peers, simply because, yes, they are vulnerable just inherently because of their situation, but also they've not been given access to that information that non-disabled young women have. So they're not quite sure where to put themselves. They're not quite sure whether to go into the background or show themselves as hypersexual in order to get attention. These are real issues that we need to be looking at within society.
It makes my heart thinking about it. And when you talk about visibility, like I've seen loads of campaigns of late because, you know, I talk about diversity and I talk about, you know, representation of bodies. But even in the campaigns that I've seen, I still see the disability as lacking.
Yeah.
And that's me just being a little bit more aware than maybe the next person over. I notice that disability is still lacking. It's very rare to see someone in a wheelchair, even in these really sort of varied campaigns. Like maybe skin color is considered, you know, body size is considered, age is considered, gender is considered, but sometimes I really feel like disability is not being considered. Is that what you're
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And yeah, I think there's numerous reasons for that. I think the fear is still there in terms of how to best communicate with a disabled person, what language and terminology should I use? That's still an issue. I think there's a bigger issue in the sense of disability just still isn't seen as attractive, as sexy. So why would you want it in a campaign? I think there's so many different issues. Another one being that so often disabled people aren't able to be in the world of work for so many different reasons, for access to all of these different things within society that we talked about earlier. It's a big, big worry and concern. And there are so many different parts of the puzzle that need to fit together before we make any real type of progress. And I think that's where the difficulty comes when it comes to disability. There is not just one easy quick fix. It is such a complex thing in inherently what it is. There's such a spectrum of it. Somebody with the same impairment can have totally different needs and requirements. It's threatening in the fluidity of the fact that you can go to bed non-disabled and wake up disabled. No other minority group really has that fluidity as a part of it. And I think all of those different things lead to a bit of a fear and a bit of a ignorance is bliss type scenario.
I think that the way that we solve it is just, I'm going to say the way that we solve it, but like, I think we need, disability just needs to be seen. It's like, we just need to swallow the fear
that
TV execs have and that, you know, advertisers have, and just get it up there, because at the moment it feels very tokenistic.
Yes, very undateables.
Oh, how do you feel about undateables? Oh, just the fucking title of it.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very problematic. And I understand where the thought process was behind it and probably where people were trying to come from, but it's become more of a, oh, isn't that lovely entertainment program rather than an education piece. And I think that's a real issue. And really just looking at the fact that most, if not all of the people on that show date other disabled people. They don't date non-disabled people, which just doesn't look at real life. It's just not how it is in real life. And it gives it's non-disabled...
I think that's so damaging. Like,
yeah.
All you guys, whether you're mentally or physically disabled, you just stick within that disabled sort of sphere.
Totally.
And yeah,
and we don't need to worry about it. We don't need to think about
you. Yeah, that's over there. You know, you just do your thing over there.
Yeah, totally.
I looked up a stat from Scope, mm-hmm. and it said that there's 13.9 million disabled people in the UK out of a population of 60 million. And, you know, that's mental, physical, visible, non-visible.
Yeah.
That's a huge number, and yet we very rarely see disability. And, you know, with that lack of visibility comes this fear. There was another stat which was from Disability Sport that says more than 60% of people say that they avoid disabled people because they don't know how to behave around them. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do the thing that's like, I have a black friend that is just not helpful in any situation. But when I was young, my best friend was disabled. She sometimes used a wheelchair, she sometimes didn't. And I have this, I think that gave me this sort of like, have a fear, but I see a fear in a lot of able-bodied people that they don't know how to be around disabled people. I see like mums yanking their kids away because a kid has just shown some sort of interest. It's the same with a kid pointing out like fat tummies or, you know, and parents recoiling with their own sort of embarrassment because they don't know, they have so much of their own fear and judgment and concern that they just are passing that on to the next generation. Is there anything that you can suggest that parents can do so that we stop this cycle of this like exclusion and fear around disability?
Allow curiosity is the biggest thing. However difficult or awkward or cringe-worthy that may feel, curiosity isn't a negative thing. Quite often it's the exact opposite. Quite often children are looking to find similar factors. Oh, look, mummy, she's in a wheelchair, just like I use my pushchair. Isn't that cool? They're looking to find indicators that are similarities rather than differences in many ways. And I would much prefer a curious child to come up to me and ask me 30 questions on a supermarket aisle than grow up to be an adult that's not asked any questions and just has lots of presumptions and lots of judgment and lots of fear, which will in turn just enable them to ignore the disabled community forever, because, hey, that's so much easier than putting yourself in a difficult position, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Especially when you get to adulthood. So I think allow curiosity and understand that many disabled people feel the way that I do, and we would all prefer to do our part in terms of education and awareness. But that doesn't mean that you are off the hook as a parent from education and building awareness yourself. Buy books that have disabled characters in them. I can't give you one right now, but I could maybe
we'll put some, we'll get our heads together after this and put some links in the show.
Yeah. But there are books out there that have disabled characters. There are children's programs that do talk about disability and difference. Make sure that these are on the reading lists and watching lists of your children, and make sure that when they do ask questions, it's not something that you just sweep under the rug in your own household. If you don't know the answer, find out and educate yourself in the process, but don't leave them with an air of nothingness when it comes to disability, because that air of nothingness will only manifest itself later on in life.
And recognize that when a child is asking a question about something around someone that they see, it's nothing to do with you and your fear. It's something to do with them, and it's use it as an education piece. I mean, totally. I say this as if I'm a parent. I'm not a parent. I don't have a clue like what it must be like to be a parent, and I don't presume to, you know, but it's when someone says, oh, you know, what do I do when someone points at someone fat in the street and I get embarrassed? I'm like, well, that's your embarrassment.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for you to have a discussion with your child about how everybody's different and everybody has different bodies, and that's wonderful, isn't that great? An opportunity to celebrate diversity. And yet, while we see that people go like the different route, it's not the not helpful route of where they're like, oh, like, let's just remove ourselves from the situation so we don't have to have these difficult conversations.
And you always find that if you do that and you remove yourself, the child will ask the question again 10 times louder. I've had that so many times. Oh, mummy, look, that girl's got pink hair and she's in a wheelchair. And if that parent doesn't answer, she'll yell it. She'll yell it 5 times louder.
So save yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And where can people find you online?
So my personal Instagram is mryates. You can find us at enhancetheuk.org, and our Instagram is Undressing Disability. And please do, if you've got any questions around anything that we've discussed to do with sexuality, please do come and find us at the Love Lounge, and we can give you some more personal advice and information. We'd love to do that.
I've not even asked you like half of the questions I have for you. So perhaps we can have another conversation at another time.
Totally. I'd be well up for that part two.
But I do want to say thank you very much. This has been enlightening, and I hope it's been really helpful for a few people.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
So lovely to see your face, Emily.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye, my love.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Emily for giving her time and answering the wandering thoughts which fly through my head every so often. You can engage Emily for any accessibility work you or your organisation may need. Give Enhance the UK a follow and ask some sexy questions on the Love Lounge. And maybe buy some books for your kids which celebrate disabled bodies. You can find loads of helpful links in the show notes. Thanks to all of you who have shared my podcast.
subscribed, and written a review. It really does help people find us. And I really appreciate every single one of you. And if you haven't done any of those things yet, then Teddy has a reminder for you this week. I'll say goodbye for now and leave you with this cuteness overload.
I hope you liked that as much as I did. Like and subscribe.